They've watched Citizen Kane a combined 200 times. Elliot's first words were, "I personally thought the use of Dutch angles was derivative in the 400 blows." In Nathan's favorite historical figure is Fritz Lang. Now they're bringing that snootiness to you with Magellan's at the Movies.
Hello, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Welcome back to Magellan's at the Movies, brought to you by myself, Elliot Eduardo Mogulyines, and yourself, Nathan Daniel Mogulyines, Nathaniel Daniel is his full name.
Yeah, thanks.
So, Nathan, well, first of all, I want to start this very selfishly by plugging something on the blog, because I have ranked all six original cast Star Trek movies for your reading pleasure.
Fine.
So yeah, go ahead and give that a read if you care. I also want to talk about Fallout. Season 2 has ended. Seen it. And the general consensus is overwhelmingly positive. Critics and audiences both really enjoy this, so keep that in mind. I have mixed feelings. There's a lot that frustrated me about this season. Characters are often in stasis. Like, I said when I talked about the first episodes of this show that I was worried that the show had spread itself too thin. And it, juggling all of these characters and storylines, it was going to struggle. That turned out to be the case. Characters are often kind of in holding patterns, or they're just off screen and their storylines feel like they're just preserved in amber until we return to them. And that kind of frustrated me. The show made some decisions. I'm not spoiling it, by the way. The show made a very pointed decision that I really disliked about a certain character and her motivations that I just always find disappointing. I'm sure people who have seen the show will know who I'm talking about. I always find it disappointing when the question of, like, how do I deal with this terrible thing that I've done or am doing is answered with, well, it's not your fault. Like, that is just such a boring, uninteresting answer to me. Than, like, actually trying to figure out how to live within that, the kinds of conflict that these decisions generate. There's an episode of Star Trek where Kirk is feeling really guilty about getting a bunch of people killed, and the conclusion is just, don't worry about it. It wasn't your fault. It turns out that actually there is this, like, secret other force that was influencing things, and it only looked like Kirk had an interesting conflict to overcome, which is obviously not very interesting.
Yeah. Well, that's too bad. I was going to ask you, because I saw that it had ended, if you had thoughts, so thanks for sharing those. I still haven't seen it. I don't know if I will, because I don't really have Prime or, like, an easy way to get Prime. But certainly your vote of no confidence is not making me rush out to get that.
I said I have mixed feelings about it, and that's true, because that stuff is true. But also, there is stuff about this show that I love. The ghoul, Walton Goggins character, I think he's been a highlight throughout this entire show. The music. I just can't shut up about how great the music is. The practical props and some of the effects I love. Sets, actual sets, rather than just green screen boxes. I recently rewatched the Star Wars prequel trilogy just green screen boxes, dude. I'm pretty sure Palpatine's desk in his office, I'm pretty sure it's CGI. No, why?
That's not true.
It is true. I don't know if it's true, but it looks CGI. And so, yeah, it's really nice to see it again. I mean, I'm still going to watch it. I'm going to watch season three. I haven't lost hope or anything like that. So, yeah, we'll see what happens.
You have a lot of hope for the Amazon Prime God of War series?
I mean, not really.
All right. The only thing I was going to say for banter was this week was the Super Bowl, which is typically a time where we get some trailers.
Weren't, like, all of the commercials? I didn't watch it, but I heard that all of the commercials were AI generated.
No, not all of the commercials, but there were quite a few commercials that either were AI generated or looked really AI generated, which either means it was AI generated or was, like, atrociously bad CGI, which is whatever. I mean, if you want to waste millions and millions of dollars on a trailer that everyone's going to make fun of you for looking terrible, that's your prerogative as a company. But I was going to ask you about really the only movie that's kind of relevant that got a trailer. Is obviously Minions 3, Minions and Monsters, you know.
Hey, I'm just
kidding. I know, I'm just kidding. Obviously, it's David Fincher's new movie, The Continuing Adventures of Cliff Booth, which is not, it's unclear if that's the actual title. That didn't have a title in the trailer. Did you see this? Are you excited for this at all? You know, what are your thoughts here?
I heard about it, but I didn't watch the trailer.
Oh.
That's an interesting choice. I do not like Once Upon a Time in America.
You mean Hollywood?
Well, both. Fincher is a weird choice for a sequel to that movie.
Yeah.
Like, Fincher is kind of, you know, he's branched out in the past with stuff like The Curious Case of Benjamin Button and Mank. But yeah, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is this kind of like bouncy, energetic, somewhat irreverent. Not thriller by any stretch of the mean, any stretch of the term, imagination, yeah. Whatever. But yeah, it's just, it's the energy of it, as I remember. Yeah. I guess maybe I'm misremembering things. The energy of it is not something that I would call remotely Fincher-esque.
No, I agree. And the energy in the trailer is very in keeping with the energy from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. That, like you said, it's kind of an irreverent romp. It's certainly has serious sort of moments, but even the climax, which is arguably the most serious sort of moment of all, is still done with a lot of, like, tongue-in-cheek sort of humor. So it seems like this movie's keeping that, although it doesn't seem as though it's keeping much of the anything else, really, from the premise. It looks like Cliff Booth is hanging out in, like, a seaside village or something. It looked kind of Florida-esque to me. Looked like there was, I don't know. It's interesting. I'm very interested by it. I also think it's funny that while David Fincher is directing another director, a sequel to another director's movie, Aaron Sorkin is making a sequel to David Fincher's movie. So we're making a little train of people doing other people's sequels.
Everyone's exchanging products.
Yeah. But very interested in it. I'll be interested to see. I'm interested just to see the movie, just because Tarantino writing and Fincher directing, interesting combination. But
forgot to mention the great Mandalorian and Grogu Budweiser commercial.
Yeah, there's a reason I'm not mentioning any of the other movies that got trailers during this. I feel like there might have been
what
another
was the
one?
Thing? I saw a screenshot of, like, someone kneeling in a scene of Jurassic Park.
Yes, there was a bit of a funny in quotes maybe, commercial where it was Jurassic Park, and so the scene where everything goes down and they lose connection to everything, and then an Xfinity guy shows up and is like, oh, don't worry, the Wi-Fi's back on, and then it's all the characters having like a good time at the park because all of the stuff works because they put it on Xfinity instead of underpaying Dennis Nedry. Although at the end, the Xfinity guy does still, like, he gets in his car and I can't remember the name of the acid spitting dinosaur.
The Dilophosaurus.
Yeah, is in his truck. And I'm like, dang, that's dark. He jumps out, but like, the implication from the movie is that's not going to help him because somehow the dinosaur can like open doors or something, I guess.
And they did use AI to recreate the characters.
They used like AI de-aging, I think, or something. I don't know. It looked better than like AI. So this is,
I mean, you can't really, AI can't really do much to de-age a fully grown man who was once a Timmy-aged child.
Yeah. I don't know. It looked good enough that you can see the vision of, right, in X amount of years, AI de-aging might look better than CGI de-aging. Although, you know, at what point is CGI and AI basically the same thing in movies? Anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about. That's enough of banter. Let's get to the movie we're talking about today, which I actually picked before I remembered that Valentine's Day is on Saturday. So this pick actually became even better.
What? I thought you did that on purpose.
I didn't. I was just thinking, James Cameron is in the news. This is a movie I was interested in talking about with you. It's also sort of in the news because Emerald Fennell said she hopes Wuthering Heights is this generation's Titanic. And so it's vaguely in the news because of that.
Put the kibosh on that.
When it makes $1 billion, she'll be proven. No, we are reviewing Titanic. It is, if you didn't know, if you're living under a rock, it's about Titanic, the tragic sinking that occurred in 1912 on my birthday, April 14th. I'm just giving out all my information today. The sinking did, and April 14th is always ever a harbinger of doom that happens on April 15th.
Right.
A lot of bad things start on April 14th.
Didn't Lincoln get shot on April 14th, and then he died the next morning?
Yeah, Lincoln was shot the night. And then also, maybe you haven't heard this one, the Dust Bowl started on April 14th. The like first dust storm of the Dust Bowl was April 14th, so... Horrible, horrible day in American history.
Dangerous to associate with you in light of this.
But Titanic, hugely successful. I haven't double-checked this, but I'm pretty in the top five highest grossing movies of all time, not adjusted for inflation. It was a gigantic smash, nominated for 14 Academy Awards, of which it won 12 of them, which is tied with the current record, tied with Return of the King, and maybe it's just Return of the King. Ben-Hur, maybe? I don't know.
If it's not just Return of the King, I think it is Ben-Hur.
Okay, Return of the King and Ben-Hur. For the most Academy Award wins of all time, it had the most nominations for a while before Sinners broke it. Hugely, I don't know about influential, but hugely successful movie, part of the zeitgeist. I was very interested to talk about it. I know both of us have seen it once before. Elliot, let's just get into this. What are your first thoughts? What?
I just imagine you stopping yourself from saying dive in because that's just in poor taste.
It is in poor taste. Let's get this started.
To delay the start of this for a little bit longer. Right. There was a Titanic exhibition in Kansas City recently, and the advertisements, like the billboards and stuff for it, described it as an immersive experience. And I thought that was in very poor taste. Either that was in very poor taste or it was just thoughtless.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, wow, that's tough.
Anyway, yeah, so I've seen this once before, like you said, and I enjoyed it that time. I remembered enjoying it. Don't remember thinking like, oh, wow, that should be one of the most successful movies of all time. But I liked it. Probably up there in terms of Cameron movies for me. What have I've just seen? I think I've just seen from Cameron Terminator 2, Aliens, and Avatar in this movie.
And Avatar 2.
Whatever. You think he's going to keep on making Avatar movies in light of the fact that they cost like $10 billion to make?
I don't know. The thing I saw was that Avatar 3 has underperformed in comparison to the previous two well enough that he might not be able to make the other ones. In which case, it seems like he knew this was a possibility, because way back in like August, he was saying, if it doesn't do well, I'll just write a book of the last two movies that I had planned. And like, that's all people will get, which is crazy.
Why not just, I know we're really like, we're spinning our wheels here, but if he could just find a way to make them more cheaply, even by like $100 million or so, like that's not much in the face of like $50 million. That's not much in terms of Avatar budgets. And then shop it around to someone else, he could make bank.
Yep. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, let's get started talking about Titanic, Elliot.
Yeah, I liked it when I first saw it. I liked it when I watched it. That was on Sunday, because the movie's really long, so I took an afternoon to watch it.
Good call.
Yeah, I thought it was good. I thought it was better than good. Well above average movie. I felt the tragedy. I quite unusual for me. I liked the romance. I thought it was a very well made, often visually arresting movie. I certainly have problems with it. It's not perfect by any means. We'll get into it, I guess. But yeah, I think this movie's good. I wouldn't object to watching it again somewhere down the line.
Wow. That's way more positive than I was expecting you to be. I think I'm in largely the same sort of place. I don't think it's a perfect movie. In fact, I think the movie is kind of front-loaded with imperfections, and then...
Really?
Oh, interesting.
No, that is interesting.
Because my experience of rewatching this was the first, like, hour had a lot of moments for me where I was like, I remember really enjoying this movie, and this is, like, not great. Maybe this movie's, like, way worse than I thought. And then it got to the actual sinking of the Titanic, and... That was the part that just blew me away, where I was like, oh, this is why I remember it fondly, because the last 45 minutes are, like, amazing, in my view, of just incredible culmination of the romance, amazing encapsulation of the tragedy of the moment, of the, like, million little tragedies that happen when this many people die in this fashion, of just this slow, inexorable drift towards everyone being in the ocean. I just think it's so, and so many amazing shots of practical effects of real water really destroying a real set. That's just, so that was kind of my, this is, I think, how I felt the first time, and this is still how I felt the second time. Maybe we start with, I think we can get into why you said, wow. Maybe a little later, but I want to start with the romance, because that's the thing that I think I'm most surprised. Like you said, you're not typically one for romance, so I'm very surprised to hear you liked this. I also think it's one of the stronger points of the movie. It's probably one of the things most people revisit the movie for. Jack and Rose, kind of an iconic movie romance. Elliot, let's go a little bit more into more detail. I almost said deeper. Let's go into it.
Have to police our language.
I know all of my metaphors for reviewing a movie are weirdly aquatic based.
Well, first of all, before I forget, I've been thinking about this since I watched the movie on Sunday, and I keep on forgetting about it and then remembering, like, oh, I have to mention this. Did you notice that at the start of the movie, in the contemporary, on the ship, the contemporary ship, Brock's friend is wearing a Watchman shirt?
Oh, no, I didn't notice that.
Yeah, it's the smiley face with the blood on it, on the forehead. It's a really cool shirt. I wish I had it.
Sick.
Anyway, yeah. Yeah, it's kind of hard to say why I liked the romance. I've written down some notes here.
Oh, nice.
And I think a big part of it is Jack. I think Jack is a very likable character.
Yeah.
He starts out very likable, and he starts their relationship out on a very likable footing. I mean, convincing someone to not commit suicide is among the most likable things you can do. I feel.
Yeah.
And yeah, just after that, the way that he carried himself, right? He had a bit of a chip on his shoulder, but he wasn't really hostile. Like, he was very game for everything. I'm thinking of when he goes to this fancy dinner, and I think that the movie's class commentary, very clunky and extremely obvious, and not one of the things that I liked about it. But yeah, I feel like there was especially in the context of the writing being around this being fairly unsubtle, there was a real threat of making Jack into this kind of figurehead for oppressed poor people. And I'm not saying that poor people aren't oppressed or weren't oppressed in 1912. Clearly they were. Yeah. I'm just saying that Jack feels very natural. He doesn't feel he doesn't feel forced. And yeah, he's joking around, talking about caviar and stuff like that. He's very kind. When he's dancing with Rose, or he goes to dance with Rose, he deliberately cheers up the little girl that he had been dancing with. And I just liked him. He seemed like a really nice guy. And I liked Rose a little bit less, mostly because, I mean, I didn't dislike her. I think my initial issue with her was just that she was, that her conflict was kind of belabored, that I've written down. There's this point in the movie where she tries to, like, cut Jack off, and she's like, oh, it will be a mistake. And then she changes her mind because she sees a young girl being kind of straitjacketed by her mother. And this prompts her to realize, oh, I want to be with Jack. I don't want to do that. And I was thinking, we've already established that you feel this way, so why is it a revelation to see it being done to someone else? But once we got over that hump, and we stopped belaboring the point of Rose does not want to be constrained, which is not a bad character motivation. It's just, I get it the first time. Once we got over that, I thought that she really held her own, and Kate Winslet and DiCaprio both did a great job, and I was just charmed by them.
Yeah, I definitely agree with all that. Jack is very charming. I definitely also agree that there's, I think, multiple points where there's kind of a double beat of Rose making the same decision twice, because it kind of happens at the end of the movie, too, where she has two opportunities to get on a lifeboat and leave Jack, and both times there's this very dramatic buildup to her refusing it and going back to be with Jack, which I just think, I'm always more critical of a movie if it's both wasting my time and very long, like,
and asking for a lot of your time.
Yeah, like a movie that's an hour and a half, if it has a couple scenes that aren't don't serve much of a function. I'm like, who cares, dude? It's an hour and a half. Like, live and learn. When it's 3 hours and 14 minutes, I'm a little more irritated. But I think the other thing that for me really sells the romance, and this is kind of true of every romance that I find compelling, is that underneath the romance, there's something also very compelling going on. And I both times I've watched the movie, the line that Rose says in the future when she's talking about Jack is she says, he saved me in every way you could save a person. And I think that's what really sells me on the movie, that beyond it being a romance of, right, two young people sort of getting caught up in the excitement of finding someone who they can share things with. And it kind of feels like when you go to, this isn't something that actually happened to me, but I can infer the experience from other things that have happened to me. But it's kind of like when you go to summer camp and you see a girl and, or a guy or whatever, you know, person what? Makes your heart flutter. Follow me on this metaphor.
Where is and this going?
It's kind of made all the more special by the fact that, you know, it's like a fleeting thing, or you know it has a chance to be a very fleeting thing, because it's like it's a new place and here's a new person and they have a new perspective, and it's so, there's something so exciting and romantic about that. And I get the same energy from Jack and Rose in this, that everything Jack is introducing Rose to is so unlike her previous experiences, and everything Rose is wanting to bring Jack into is so different for him, that there's something very exciting and young to it that's very fun to watch and I think done very well. But I think beyond that, I think Rose is such a fantastic, I really like that she's not just falling in love with Jack, she's falling in love with being alive. She's realizing that beyond the constraints of the life she's lived up to now, there's all of these amazing, exciting things she can do, and that her life doesn't have to be a gilded cage from here until she dies. It can be whatever she wants it to be. And I think that's what really sells me on the romance of the movie, that beyond her falling in love with Jack, she's also falling in love with, like, being alive. I mean, it's very obvious, but, like, at the beginning of the movie, she wants to die, right? She's ready to throw herself off the ship because she's so trapped by her own life. And by the end of the movie, right, she is fighting to live and fighting to create a life that we then, in the scenes in the future, get to see that she did live. And I think that's what really sells it for me, and sells it for a lot of people, that beyond just being a romance, it's also a fairly compelling story about a person falling in love with all of this other stuff.
Yeah, that's true. Can't say that I noticed any of that when I watched the movie, but I can definitely see it. Mm. I guess I it sounds like I might have enjoyed this romance on a much more superficial level than you did, because I was just like, oh, that's nice. That's nice for them. This whole experience with meeting a girl at summer camp, is that something you have experience
no,
with?
No, I said at the beginning, this isn't like my personal experience, but from...
Oh, I didn't hear that.
Like, I can infer it from other times I've been in a place and there's... I don't know. I don't have to explain everything. I think, real ones get what I'm talking about.
Well, I guess I'm not a real one.
Yeah, send us an email if you're a real one. But, yeah, I think the next thing I want to know, it's burning me up inside. Why do you say wow after I said the beginning is the weaker part of the movie from the ending?
I didn't like the ending, and I'm as surprised as you are, but the main problem that I had is that, well, it's two things. One, the fiance is much more of a driving force in the climax, and I hated the fiance. Mm-hmm. Thought he was such an annoying, one-dimensional villain, and in a story where, this is the thing, you just don't need him. You don't need him to create stakes or danger or anything. He's just there to be a one-dimensional, utterly predictable, selfish jerk. Mm-hmm. And I was really tired of him. I was really tired of him by the time the movie ended. And also, you said, and I agree, with that the movie has an issue of sort of running characters through cycles that are very repetitive. And I felt that way. I felt very strongly like that was happening in the... at the end. Because I've written it down. Climax is starting to drag, especially as we go through cycles of escaping the underbelly, finding a boat, escaping the underbelly, finding a boat, lifeboat, I mean. Yeah. And it's just sort of repeating. Like, Rose gets Jack, they have to escape the underbelly, they have to find a lifeboat, the fiancé chases them back into the underbelly, they have to escape the underbelly, they have to find a lifeboat. And I was like, all right, we've been through this. Let's move on. It is a visually, feels kind of weird to say spectacular, a visually arresting sequence. And I agree with the thing about the practical effects. I mean, there's a shot of water gushing into a large room that I think is practical. And I was like, wow, that's a lot of water. How are they doing this?
Yeah.
I guess I was like, I already feel the danger because the ship is sinking. I don't need Hockley to be firing a gun at them. That's ridiculous. And I definitely don't need to see them navigating the bowels of the ship twice in the span of like 20 minutes.
Hmm. Yeah, I can see that. And I definitely agree that Hockley is not a particularly compelling character, and yeah, when he's chasing them with a gun, it is kind of like, good grief, man, like, the ship is sinking, focus on yourself, like, do some inward soul searching. But I think, and this is always gonna happen with movies, is different people focus on different things and it changes their experience of watching it. I just feel like the ending sequence is able to just so well convey, like I said at the beginning, the tragedy of the event, that I think it's hard to, and this is kind of this similar to what Spielberg does in Schindler's List, that by zooming in on particular people, he's really able to convey the tragedy of what is happening here, right? That over 1,000 people are going to die in an inevitable event that everyone is doing their best to try and avoid, and they are incapable of doing so. So many different little pieces in this finale, I just think so brilliantly conveys that, and so does that so well. Like the captain locking himself into the room, and kind of just the way the captain is, Mr. Andrews, all of these people who have in some way or another caused what is currently happening, just wandering around dumbfounded at their own hubris and the devastating ramifications of that hubris. And we have stuff like all of the different crew characters trying their best to save as many people as they can while, right, they clearly have no ability to do this. I read a book about the sinking of the Lusitania, and it talks about a similar thing, that for a lot of these crews, because there was like no conception of, oh, we might have to bring out the lifeboats to save everyone because the ship might sink, when it came time to do that, it was just like a mess. And we see that here in the Titanic, right, that the crew don't know how many people they're supposed to put in the lifeboat. That at one point Andrews is telling the guy, I saw a boat with 12 people and it can hold up to like 70. And so I think all of these things, that's, you know, right, the band playing, the shots of, right, a mom putting her kids to bed or trying to get them to go to sleep, the couple hugging in the bed, there's just so many pieces of this ending that I think are so well done that, yeah, I agree there's some, like, spinning of wheels as they're trying to, like, force Jack and Rose into the final position where they're stuck. That can be kind of frustrating. Like, we've talked about before that it's annoying to see characters forced into a thing as opposed to, like, the natural progression of the plot forcing them into thing, or at least feeling like it's more random writing. But again, this whole ending is so... The whole experience of the Titanic sinking is filled with so many moments of people doing irrational, crazy things because they're looking death in the face, that it doesn't, to me, feel like, oh, this is so ridiculous. They're forcing them under the ship again. It's like, yeah, Hockley's insane, and he's now been driven even more insane by the fact that his fiance's leaving him for someone who he thinks is, like, dirt. And so, yeah, I think he would pull out his gun and do something crazy like that. And so then they're under there. Is that the second time they've been under the ship? Yeah, but, like, both times it felt fairly believable the way, to me at least, the way they got them into that position.
Wow, interesting. let's talk about some historical facts that I learned, because after I watched this, I, as is so often the case with movies and stuff about history, I decided to learn more about the event. So some cool things that I learned. The band playing did happen, although they were not playing on the deck. They were playing inside the ship. And actually, the stuff that I read deliberately went out of their way to say that it's probably unlikely that they played Nearer My God to Thee, because that's just in very poor taste. But different people have different recollections, and that's one of the difficult things about such a chaotic event is eyewitness accounts are going to conflict, because people are going to remember things differently. The fate of the captain and the fate of Mr. Andrews is unknown. There were reports that Mr. Andrews was, like, standing around, basically, smoking while the ship was sinking. But there were also reports that he was fairly animated. There were reports that the captain went down with the ship, and also people who said that they saw him jump into the water. So it's one of those things where you don't really know. The guy, what is his name? Mr. Ismay?
Yes.
The guy who, like, did he design the ship or finance the ship?
I think finance, because he's the guy talking about wanting to make headlines. So I assume that he's got a monetary investment in making headlines.
Yeah, he was a very controversial survivor. And I can't remember why, if it was because of the circumstances of how he got onto a lifeboat, or just the fact that he did get onto a lifeboat, that there was this perception that as kind of the architect of this disaster, he should have been one of the ones to pay the price. I'm not sure if that makes sense, but that is a feeling. And he was sort of viewed as a coward by a lot of people when it came to light that he had survived. Mr. Guggenheim did actually get into, like, his Sunday best for the reason of he wants to look good or dying. That's interesting. Yeah, this happened 2 years before World War One.
Yeah. If you want another outside the movie sort of fun fact, there's an insane moment in the Best Picture winner for, has to be like 1934, 35-ish, Cavalcade, a very middling to, like, bad movie about a British family during the turn of the century, does feature an insane moment where one couple that you've kind of been following finally gets married and goes on their honeymoon, and they're standing on this ship talking about how excited they are and all of the amazing things they're gonna do and how they're, you know, just so young and so anticipating all the beautiful things of life. And then they, like, walk out of the frame revealing the name of the ship is the HMS Titanic, which is insane. That's an insane moment. That's like two people going on a honeymoon and like visiting the two towers and then revealing it's September 11th. Like, that's an insane thing to do. It's crazy. And it's forever enshrined in Best Picture history. Cavalcade. Take a watch. It's crazy. Anyway.
Okay, well, if I could just say, Titanic would have been RMS Titanic, not HMS Titanic, because it was a merchant ship, not a naval, not a military or government ship.
Maybe it was. Well, I really feel like it was HMS, which just continues the, like, poor quality of the film.
One more thing that I wanted to say about the sinking of the ship is I really liked the scene where they realized that it was going to sink. Just like the fact that the gut punch when he said, Mr. Andrews said, like, this ship is done for. There is too much water and too many compartments and it's going to ship. And I really liked the line when Mr. Ismay says, this ship can't sink. And Mr. Andrews says, she's made of iron. I assure you she can. That was really good.
I don't know if you saw this in your research, but I saw it because I looked up the Wikipedia article. They have a photo of the iceberg that they're pretty sure did it. You can't see it because the photo's in black and white, but according to people who took the photo, they could see, like, red paint on the iceberg. And it was from, I guess, the ship that showed up to save them. But that's crazy.
I did see the picture. I heard, maybe I'm misremembering, but I heard that the red was thought to be like rust that had rubbed off from the Titanic.
Yes. Yeah. That's how they assumed it was the right iceberg. Anyway, back to the movie. What did you think of the scenes in the present, kind of the framing device of the movie, which takes up, I think, like the first 20-some minutes, and then takes up most of the epilogue, and then a couple of times in between that. But what did you think of these sections?
I didn't really think much of them, or much about them. I was kind of just, it is a very framing device. I don't feel like it really contributed that much. I know that James Cameron, just in his regular life, is obsessed with this event, and he's been to the wreck, like, multiple times. So maybe he just wanted to show people how cool it is to get down there. I thought, in 2026, when they're at the wreck and the guy says, if this glass or this ship fails, we'll be gone in like 0.5 nanoseconds. That hits a little different. I can't imagine what that would be like. I just don't have that much to say. I'm not really 100% sure why it was included, why they felt like, I guess because maybe people don't really think about the Titanic in today's day and age, or certainly when it was being made. It came out in 1997, so they were like, hey, this thing happened, it's relevant in the here and now, there are people alive who, it happened within living memory. Maybe that was it. I don't really know. I'm just not sure what to make of it.
Yeah. Like I said before, when a movie's 3 hours and 14 minutes long, I get a little harsher with what needs to be cut. And yeah, I just don't really see the purpose of this. I get that it's maybe to show that, right, Rose did go on and live the life that she hoped she would be able to live, which is certainly exciting. I feel like you could probably convey that just as well with, like, a little epilogue thing of her funeral and her having, like, a lot of people there. And then she can go to Titanic heaven or whatever on earth is happening here in that last scene. But it just, it feels like it takes way too long. And yeah, I get I think maybe that's right. The idea that they're trying to impress upon you that this event is important. But I feel like the movie itself impresses. Like, if you can watch the last 50 minutes and you're like, who cares about this nonsense? Like, that's your fault. I don't think that's the movie's fault. The movie has done everything it possibly could to make you care about this event and the people who experienced it. And if you're still going to be like, it's not relevant, which I guess it's not, but like, it's as relevant as any other tragedy that's happened throughout history. So I don't really, it feels like it takes way too long. And yeah, I don't think it's great.
Yeah, Titanic Heaven is interesting. As has been pointed out multiple times, Rose had an actual husband with whom she lived for most of her life. He's not there.
Yeah.
So who knows what kind of heaven that guy's in.
Well, and also, and presumably everyone's there, right? Like, her fiancé's probably there. Her mom's there. Like, the only people there who she likes is, like, Jack and his friends or whatever. I don't know. It's just weird. It's a weird ending. It feels to me like the ending of, spoilers, but the ending of Pan's Labyrinth, where it's like, you're just making stuff up now, bro. Come on now.
It's also weird because everyone's focusing on, everyone's like arrayed themselves for Rose and Jack, and I was like, don't any of you have loved ones you want to reunite with? What do you care about these people? It's like in The Fault in Our Stars when they get applauded for kissing in, what is it, Anne Frank's basement?
The Anne Frank house.
That's inappropriate. I feel. How do the people know? How do the people there not know that they're like neo-Nazis who are just like getting excited or they're something? And this is utterly depraved.
Yeah. I think, I guess, I don't see much else in my notes for this. I think I already kind of mentioned this when I talked about the practical effects of the end of the movie. But I do think on a technical level, this movie is really impressive. I have to assume a lot of the wide shots are CGI, because I don't think they had like a Titanic 2 scale set to have, but they look really good, much better than some of the CGI wide shots from like Revenge of the Sith, where you're like, that's not what Ewan McGregor looks like, don't be silly with me. But yeah, it looks great. I love the colors in the scene with the sunset where Rose and Jack are like hanging out on the ship. The sunset looks great. It looks like Gone with the Wind, which is a movie with a horrible plot but incredible visuals. The music is really good. My Heart Will Go On, obviously a heater of a song by Celine Dion. Crazy good.
What does that play? I was listening for it the whole time.
It plays over the credits, but they do use it as, like, they liked it so much that they used it. I don't remember, don't take this as a fact, but I want to say they liked the song so much that the composer for the regular music uses it as, like, a leitmotif throughout the movie, or it could be the other way around, that they told her, hey, we'd love a song, and she used the, like, love theme that plays as her song. So it plays, the non-vocal version of it plays a couple of times, but the song plays over the credits.
Oh.
It's a great song.
I knew there was a famous song associated with this movie, but I didn't hear anyone singing until, I guess I just pieced out before it started playing on the credits.
That is possible.
I want to say that I really like the sets. I love sets. I like practical sets. What can I say?
Yeah.
And these sets are very nice, highly detailed, presumably accurate to some degree. I don't know. Yeah. It must have been, there must have been like some kind of set that they had built that could be lifted up.
Yeah.
Or was on, like, a... I'm not even sure what you would call such a device. A rig.
Mm-hmm.
So that's impressive. I really liked Kathy Bates in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
I thought she was very charming, very funny. I was sad when she didn't really play that much of a part in the movie. Although, I thought, again, a moment where I really felt the tragedy of the movie was when she is encouraging people to row back to save people, and they can't bring themselves to do it out of the, I think, justifiable worry of swamping the boat.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine what that would be like.
Yeah.
And it's hard to put yourself in that position, just like it's hard to put yourself in the position when you watch Schindler's List and you're like, would I be courageous enough? Would I have the strength to do something different? I don't know, man. It's a tough question. Hopefully one that we'll never have to answer. Sort of a there but for the grace of God go I or something.
Yeah.
And it is also, again, accurate to what I learned. And some of the most harrowing testimony that I read was just people talking about the sound of, like, I mean, people use some pretty colorful language to describe just everyone in the water, like, just moaning and howling and stuff. It sounded it was rough, and I think the movie captured it pretty well.
I think the shot of the ship that Mr. Fantastic brings back,
that threw me. Because I saw him, he's in one shot at, like, the very beginning of the movie when they're casting off. And I was like, that's Mr. Fantastic. And then he doesn't show up until the very end of the movie.
Yeah. But the shot of his ship coming in through the corpses of everyone who's frozen is just, it's so good. It's just, very well done. I also, my final point before we can get to ratings is, I just want to say, clearly, Jack would not fit on that door, and certainly would not fit on the door in a way that both of them wouldn't, like, capsize the door and die. The shot of Rose from above, I feel like, clearly shows that there's not enough room. And I would, like, this doesn't matter, because it's, you know, the characters try it, and then they decide to not continue trying. So even if they could perfectly fit, Jack decides, I'm not gonna try it, I'm happy if just Rose lives. But I just wanted to throw my hat into that perennial debate or discussion point from the movie. My two cents.
I thought Mythbusters did something where they proved that they both could have been on the door.
Yeah, but again,
I mean, I'm not saying that Mythbusters are infallible.
They prove it where it's like, if we do a bunch of planning and arrange ourselves in the perfect way, I think they even say in the episode, they're like, yeah, they could have, but, like, they're both freezing to death. And they just, fell into the ocean in this insane ship sinking. They're not going to be like, guys, let's get the physics of this right.
You cut out there for a second. So I was just kind of doing my own thing. And just to offer a quick clarification, HMS stands for His or Her Majesty's Ship, which is a designation for ships contracted for use or built for use in the British Navy. RMS stands for Royal Mail Ship, which just means that it's authorized or designated to carry British mail. So there was British mail on the ship. I'm not sure if not every civilian ship is designated RMS, that there are some civilian ships that don't carry British mail. But in case you're wondering, that's what all that means.
Great. Let's get into ratings.
So I think you didn't actually find it great. I thought that was really interesting.
Great. I'm so happy for you. I'm ready to rate this. I think if this movie was only the last, like, hour, I think this would be a top-tier movie for me. But it does have the opening hour. It has a lot of double beats. It's got this kind of useless, in my opinion, framing device, which I'm sure this is another case where Titanic super fans are going to be all up in my business.
And James Cameron.
Yeah, all up in my business saying, no, it functions for this. You're so dumb. You don't get the point. Whatever, dude. Who cares? And I think the opening of the movie, I love the romance, but it kind of takes a bit to get going. And yeah, I don't like this whole sequence. I didn't say it as emphatically before, but I don't like that sequence where Rose, like, rejects Jack. It feels kind of pointless, and it just kind of feels even more spinning wheels than other times where there's a double sort of beat. But I think overall, this movie is really good. I'd agree with your assessment. I'd enjoy watching it. I'd never look down my nose on someone who said, hey, let's watch Titanic. I'd be like, okay, that's going to be a long time, but it's a good movie. I'd be happy to watch it. I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10.
Yeah, I enjoy this movie. I like the characters. Well, I don't like the fiance. I like most of the characters. I enjoy the production, just the technical mastery on display here. James Cameron knows how to make a movie. What can I say? If he didn't know how to make movies, he probably wouldn't be as rich as he is. Yeah, I liked the romance. Thought it was endearing. I didn't like the tragedy. I felt the tragedy. I was moved by the tragedy. I feel like there's definitely room to be trimmed, for this to be trimmed, but, right, it's just one of those things. I'm going to give it a B+.
Nice. Nice, nice, nice. That takes us to the recommendation portion. I'm going to go first. I'm almost positive you haven't seen this movie, so there's no risk of us recommending the same thing. But I'm going to recommend Brooklyn, a movie from...
That's my favorite movie, Nathan.
That's not true. Movie from a couple years back, Best Picture nominee, kind of one of the underseen Best Picture nominees, I would say, from this year. I want to say it was 2017, 16, maybe. Saoirse Ronan movie. It follows Saoirse Ronan as a woman who decides to emigrate to America during the time when a lot of Irish people were immigrating to America. And then she falls in love with an Italian. And I'm not going to give away too much else of the plot. But I think if you like the Titanic because it's both a romance and something kind of going on underneath the romance, I think this is a fantastic movie. Super charming romance between the two leads. You'll definitely like them. You'll be rooting for them. It's very cute. But also, it's a really fantastic movie about homesickness in some sense. That, you know, when you leave the place that you've grown up and lived forever, that's tough. And it's really hard to then live in a new place and try to make new friends. And the scenes near the beginning of this movie where Saoirse Ronan's character is dealing with this homesickness are really fantastic and incredibly compelling. Obviously, Saoirse Ronan does an incredible job. She's an very talented actress. And yeah, it's just, I'd say it's a very fun movie. It's a great romance. It's got a great sub thing going on beyond the romance that I think is very compelling and very well done. Also, Domhnall Gleeson shows up. He's fantastic. I love Domhnall Gleeson. So yeah, that's going to be my recommendation if you like the romance and the other stuff from the Titanic.
That's interesting. What happened to Saoirse Ronan? Did she, like, retire or something?
No, she, well, I guess she hasn't had a movie in a bit. I want to say she had a movie 2 years ago, The Outrun, that people were really nutty about, but I don't know if she's been in anything since then. I don't know. I have a friend on Letterboxd who goes to every single Saoirse Ronan movie, so I could check that. He goes to a lot of movies, but he makes a point of going to Saoirse Ronan movies because he likes her as an actress.
Fair enough. She's very good. That's interesting. I haven't seen that, so I can't comment. My recommendation, this is going to be a bit of a cheat, but I'm going to recommend the HBO miniseries Chernobyl. I decided to do this. There's no romance. Well, there's a little romance in this miniseries. But mostly I decided to do it because this is also about a historical tragedy, but it takes a much more procedural investigative angle of like finding out specifically on a not just a political but a scientific level how an RBMK reactor explodes.
They can't.
Is how does an RBMK they're nuclear reactors, Nathan. I assure you they can. Yeah. Now you made me lose my train of thought again. It's just like, it's fantastic, dude. And I listened to the podcast where the creator, Craig Mazin, explains after every episode what went into the episode and the history behind it. It's absolutely fascinating. And so if you liked Titanic, we didn't really talk about this, but there's definitely an element in Titanic of that, like, Babylonian arrogance.
Yes.
Of people thinking that they have built something that is permanent, that is indestructible. The Soviets, if nothing else, thought that they built indestructible stuff. So, yeah, if you liked it for that angle, and if you just like a sort of a very patient, in-depth, thorough reconstruction and deconstruction of a historical event, watch Chernobyl. It's also, if you like scary stuff, Chernobyl is the scariest media that I've ever seen that's based on a true story. I mean, right, I guess The Conjuring is based on a true story, based on a verifiable true story.
It's verifiable. There were people who said it happened. They verified it, Elliot.
I guess based on a thoroughly documented true story.
That's funny. That is great. I go to pub trivia every Monday with a couple of other guys, and I'd say about once a month or every other month, Chernobyl comes up either in trivia or just in conversation, and we all just talk about, dude, what a great show. It's so good. It was so good, I even convinced one of them to read the book, Midnight in Chernobyl, that our dad read that he loves about the same event. And yeah, we love it. It's a great show.
Great show. It also tells us that life is hard and full of disappointments.
That's so true. One of those disappointments is tragically going to be next week. We are not going to be recording. I'm going on a little vacation, so I will not be available to record. I don't know if I told Elliot this before we started recording. I assumed
the first time I've heard of it.
Well, you knew I was going on vacation.
That's true.
You could have inferred it, but yeah. So we're not going to be back next week, but the week following, we're going to be back with another brand new episode. Super excited for that. Thank you so much for listening. As always, don't forget to send us an email if you want to do a request, if you want to, you know, say, dang, that's so true, what you said about meeting people at summer camp. That's so amazing of you, Nathan.
Where I met my wife.
Yeah, someone could say that. Feel free. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. We hope you have a great time. Until then.